Hello, welcome to episode 12 to Hong Kong Gore. I am your host, Wing Ho Lin, pronouns he, him.
Hello, I'm Matthew, and my pronouns are he, him. Sorry, I'm just making a figure thing because you just did that hello.
Yeah, before. I did because I needed to like just get it out of my system because it's like, you know when you're like, I don't know, you went through like the whole weekend just in front of your laptop writing notes down and writing other stuff and then you realize, oh, I haven't spoken to anyone or like, communicated with anyone for like a good 24 hours. And right
is this
now,
a cry for help?
Please give me. Yeah, you know what? To be fair, I did go see a show last night, a friend's show,
It was
The Little Mermaid. It's okay. Like a musical and a very like for amateur theatre production, it's actually quite. They really went all out in terms of like the spectacle and
it's right.
Yeah. So I, you know, props for them. But I went there and I immediately, you know, that feeling when you go to like a somewhat pseudo social event, that tightness in your chest where I'm like, oh. I at least I know that.
To people.
Yeah, exactly. How do I talk to people? Will they remember me? I don't know. You know, how do I? You know, it's very much one of those feelings. I mean, it's very much a me problem. To be fair, like I'm okay in like a work environment or like or a creative environment where it be dance or acting or just because it has something. There's a task where I get to focus on, and I guess talking to people is easier because I'm not putting so much pressure on it. I tend to see it as like a byproduct. Not that I don't put any care for it, but for me, it's because it's a byproduct of like the main task I'm actually doing. I never put so much focus on it. Where I was going to like a social event or pseudo social event, like going to see a show and then seeing the people who perform in it and people who are watching it. That to me is like, oh, this is the main focus. I have to like, there's a feeling to perform, I suppose, or feeling that I have to like, oh yeah, I have to step up and like be merry and like talk to people and be like a social animal. And I don't find that to be my natural muscle. It takes me a while to sort of work myself up, to be fair, unless I'm like someone with, who I'm really comfortable with, which frankly
dude,
I do have.
I work from home for several years before going back to work recently, and my job is mostly working from home, but I still do come to the office from time to time. I had last year to go back to an office space to talk to and interact with new people, and some of them were actually French people. So not only did I have to accommodate myself to talking to people I didn't know in a work environment, which I hadn't done in ages, I also had to do it in a different language. Do you know how awkward that was?
Yeah.
So really difficult. I had to genuinely apologize to people being like, I don't know how to talk to you for a second. Just let me.
Yeah.
I had to genuinely explain to people how I was rewiring my brain, basically.
To speak
to them. So, no. I like 100%. It is. I don't think it's just a you problem. I think it's most people would probably have that issue because, social interaction is a different kind of muscle. And when it comes to, environment that you know, like I had gone to shows, for example, in between working from home, I had gone to shows, but you're at a show, you don't necessarily talk to people, or you talk to people via a very coded way. So it's a completely different type of interaction. So, makes sense. So, yes, you're completely allowed for going hard at the beginning. It is a completely normal thing to do. And we spent 4 minutes talking about this. So,
yeah. Let's move on. Listen, enough of our personal issues. So I'm very excited about this episode because not only I was going to, you know what? I was going to say, this is our finally, we're finally going to do a Category 3 film. The True. Film that we're about to be watching or discussing technically wasn't Category 3 or released Category 3. It was actually Category 2.
From my
during my research, I could be, it may be like an updated rating, but from what I've actually researched on the film, it was released as category 2. Having said that,
it makes sense because I didn't find the violence to be shocking. But then at the same time, that's also something I don't think we discussed previously. But like the Prison and Fire movie that we discussed a few episodes ago.
That was more shocking than. I find the violence in that film more shocking than.
But also, it's been moved to category 3.
Very recently.
That's also an update. Like, so perhaps maybe Taxi Hunter wasn't a category 3 or was a category 3 when it came out, but like was moved to a different thing because those things fluctuate and they reassess things. So for example, we already technically talked about a category 3 movie, but only after the fact, because when we talked about it, it wasn't a category 3 movie and now it is. Because we wanted to talk about another movie too, but do you want to talk about what is a category 3 movie first?
So a category 3 film is essentially an equivalent to an NC-17 in the US or a rated 18, but a hard 18 in terms of rating. A category 2 film can be considered somewhere around a 50, maybe a 12 way, depending, but mostly 15. So once you reach category 2A and 2B, they tend to like hit more of the harder stuff, and they'd be considered some on the upper echelon of 15 or just hitting 18. And category 3 would be considered a hard 18, much like NC-17. And most of those films will employ, exploitative elements such as sex, violence, horror. Anything
also
that goes
display of codes or things that are related to the triads.
That's true. So anything that's deemed morally reprehensible or questionable. But it's a very interesting category or interesting rating system, because a category 3 rating basically ended up becoming sort of a subgenre an umbrella term that identifies certain exploitative films, namely the stuff from Wong and Herman Yao in the early days, such as Ebola Syndrome, where it's intense horror, intense gore, intense sexual situations, often sexual violence. I mean, if your film has sexual violence, it's automatic that it will get a category 3. I can't think of anything
Raped by an Angel series, I would imagine.
Exactly.
There's a bunch of those where every time I see the title, I'm like, oh, well, that's probably a category 3 movie.
More or less, that's the case. And when the category 3 was only introduced in the early 90s, and I think it was so they can actually release a specific film. I don't remember. I wonder if it's actually Erotic Ghost Story, but it was only introduced in the early 90s, and slowly moving on as those films became more popular, the category 3 films, they're mostly identified concerning films that has, sexual elements in it. These films can also vary as well. They can actually employ other stuff. But like you said, mentioned the gangster films where you do display gangster elements, like real life gangster elements, you automatically will get a category 3.
Yeah, I can't remember if we talked about it in the podcast or it's just between us, but The Movie Exiled by Jonito is one of those where you mentioned that, because they do a specific hand gesture.
Basically
an actual gang sign or a way to recognize the gangsters, and that was a category 3 movie because of that reason.
Exactly. And that was really somewhat of a more recent phenomenon, because I think portrayal of gangsters, I mean, gangsters have been portrayed for yonks in cinema, and admittedly, they were mostly glamorized, but I think it came to a point where, it became an actual problem, I think I would say in the late 90s, mostly with the Young and Dangerous series. I don't know if you actually heard of those films, but it's a long-running... So it's essentially a long-running series. There's literally like 8 films involving the Young and Dangerous franchise. Yeah, and it's actually based on a comic book that focused on Triad Kids and how the trials and tribulations of like Triad Kids. But it was like these characters were depicted by mostly young, up-and-coming pop stars. So there was definitely an element of glamorization to a point of where it gets kind of ludicrous, actually.
Right.
And it actually, though, I think there were like news reports that the Young and Dangerous films were the prime problem for youngsters of that era for getting into
Like poverty or like social issues?
No, the movies, the whole Mortal Kombat bullshit again, you know, it's like exactly. So in terms of like gangsters, I think now, I think it was, I don't know if it was, if the Young and Dangerous films had started that sort of movement where, oh, if you have a gangster film and it's actually depicting triads in a realistic way, that is actually somewhat glamorized in any way, shape, or form, it's automatically category three.
Right,
but
okay.
pre mid-90s, like mainly in the early 90s, it's mostly identified with like mostly horror elements, exploitative elements such as, you know, like I said, sexual violence. And
yeah, that's mostly what I associate with category three movie, especially exactly. When it's being reissued as it's going to be a category three movie, like as a selling point, it's definitely not.
Yeah.
Because like you can't find so many, like The Godfather would then be considered the category for a movie because portrays mobsters in a somewhat positive light.
Although I remember back in like the DVD days where Godfather, like all the Godfather films were like 18s and now they're like 15, so it's like in the UK, yeah.
No, funny, because I think in France they probably were just 12.
Oh yeah. Okay.
But then rating is different in France.
Rating
like for
is
example,
yeah.
We talked about 18. Like we talk about a rating that has an effect on who can access the movie.
Yeah.
In France in particular, if you compare a category 3 movie to a triple X classification, which is pornographic movie or 18.
Yeah. Or R18 in the UK. I think if it's a pornographic film, it's an R18.
Most movie theaters cannot legally show those movies.
Yeah.
Because it has to have a specific license to show a triple X or 18 plus movie.
That's actually similar in the UK, in that you must be a licensed sex shop in order to sell pornographic.
But for example, for like there was a movie called Martyr, a French horror movie that was classified as 18 plus for whatever reason, and there was a big campaign to change that rating, which ultimately became just a 16 plus, because if it was 18 plus, it wouldn't be able to be shown in any cinema at all, because there is virtually no erotic cinema anymore in France. So you wouldn't be able to show it even if it was like a horror film that could have potentially brought people in. Well, yeah, sure, but like there's no room to show it, so like even if it brings people in, that's just like two spaces in Paris and that's it, if they even still exist. So it's something that really isn't possible anymore. The movie is very overrated, by the way. If anybody listening to this and thinks it's good, I'm willing to fight you.
Exciting.
It was boring.
I mean,
regardless.
So our main subject of the podcast is Taxi Hunter. Now, I would say it is category two, but having said that, it's often lumped together with the other category three films, largely because of the involvement of Anthony Wong and Herman Yao, who collaborated before and after a lot, mostly for the three films. The most infamous Untold Story and Ebola Syndrome, two of the most infamous category three films. So it's often
another one recently, like I'm sure for all time's sake.
Yes, I also had the DVD of it. I know what you're talking about. It's something about I forgot the name of it because I didn't think I would be talking about it. But it's essentially about Anthony Wong trying to, what's the term where you can't sleep?
Oh, insomnia.
Insomnia. Yeah, something. It's essentially something as insomnia or sleep deprivation that causes him to become a cannibal. As you do.
I do when I do not have a good sleep. I start looking at people around me and go like, tasty.
You look tasty. But yeah, they have done one recent, like really recent. Well, I say recently. It's like, I think it was like 2008. It was definitely 2017.
2022 or something, yeah.
Regardless,
those two seem to get along pretty well. So
exactly.
That's probably why they did the movie.
But it, like I said, Taxi Hunter, the main subject of the podcast, is often lumped together with the other category of free films. And I think largely because it does incorporate some of the exploitative elements. Having said that, it does actually add complexity to those exploitative elements, and it makes it for a more, I'd say, engrossing watch compared to those other films where it's very carnal in terms of how you view it. It's like it's violence for violence sakes. That basically every person or character that commits these heinous acts are essentially heinous people. Whereas with this, in this case, in Taxi Hunter, our main protagonist, Kin, is not heinous at all, and yet he does commit heinous acts because of the fact that he's going through trauma and such. But before we go into Taxi Hunter, and speaking of trauma, and speaking of 18 films, we want to discuss another film that we both recently watched, so we can actually have a bit of a back and forth instead of like, oh, one listening one to the other. We have actually, and I think it's related because director / actor, I think / script writer actually.
Yeah, well, he's
is also in yeah. Dev Patel is also a big fan of Hong Kong cinema, and I guess Asian cinema, because I think he does throw in a bit of South Korean cinema in there as well. We've both watched Monkey Man, like I said, starring and directed by Dev Patel, and you know what? It's such an interesting film, and it was actually a recommendation on your behalf, and also a friend in our circle, Ramsey. Everyone's saying it's like, oh, it's such an interesting action film, and you know, it's great, and it's, you know, it's so hard hitting. And I think Ramsey did say that it was like it's the best action film since John Wick, or the first John Wick, which, you know, I don't know.
I don't agree, exactly.
But I will agree that, yes, Monkey Man is such an interesting film, but I don't know if I want to call it an action film, and I would like to, like, sort of, like, break that down. But, no,
I agree with you, actually, yes.
Yeah?
It's,
okay,
I don't think it's a good idea to call it an action film, just because it's so sparse, or at least...
Yeah? It doesn't seem to be the main focus.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, for me, I compare always action films the same way I would... look at a pornographic movie, where the main point is a specific type of scene. What's in between links all those scenes together, and there's, you know, various quality to those two types of movies. But for sure, what you come in to see when you watch an action film, like a Fast and Furious movie, compared to any pornographic movie, is specifically the moment where specific type of actions take place. And in the case of Monkey Man, it's not so much that you do not get those scenes where there's fighting involved. It's just that, like, it takes at least... There's one at the beginning, and then after that, it takes a while to happen and the characters develop. And then, but more importantly, it feels like the action is not really the main point. Like, it's not really what you... If you come in to see Monkey Man and see only action scenes, I think you would be disappointed.
And you know what? I think for a moment I was kind of disappointed when I entered the cinema and like watched it fully expecting, because that's how it was sold to me.
Yeah.
Like in terms of the trailer, it was sold to me as like the Indian John Wick, and I really fucking wish they didn't do that, because, and honestly, but to be honest with you, you know what? I think it's my problem. Stop watching trailers, because that's currently what I
mean.
What I
this
should
one
be doing.
Was very badly done. I'm sorry for whoever cut it, but I think they were probably told set it like a John Wick movie.
Yeah.
And even I, when I watched the trailer, I was like, "This is not a good trailer." I wanted to see it because I really adore Dev Patel, and I think he's a fantastic actor. And in The Green Knight, he's amazing. He's such a, it's a fucking masterpiece. He's such a great actor in it. He was also in, he plays in David Copperfield.
Oh, yes. The Life of David
exactly.
Copperfield or something like that.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah,
he's really, really good in that. So
yeah.
I really admire this actor. I think he's got a fantastic range. I think he's a fantastic actor. And when I saw that he was doing something, I was like, I want to see it, regardless of whatever the fuck it is. I just want to see it.
Yeah.
And the trailer, I thought, was god-awful. Because it gave me the impression that this was going to be an action film. But because the movie isn't that much of an action film...
Yeah, yeah.
It's really hard to sell it as a trailer and be like, oh, look, there's all those punches. And like,
yeah. And the whole idea of the mythology of like the monkey, it's a specific legend, Indian legend or folklore called Hanuman. And it's funny because the trailer sold it as if like, oh, he's going to be kicking ass while wearing a monkey mask. That isn't the case.
No, not at all. Where's the monkey mask in the ring?
That's a wrestling thing that it's probably, and it's, and to be honest with you, it's not something that's actually played too much on. It's just something that he just uses for to actually earn money, but he's not out there dressed as a monkey and fighting crime like a la Batman. Do you know what I mean? But I think in terms of like the whole idea of how you use employ Hanuman is so interesting. Eh? Like from a narrative perspective, and this is why I hesitate to call this an action film, because I think this film employs many of the sort of action tropes that you see in like particularly like martial arts cinema. But I think constantly subverts them numerous times, and to the point where, oh, this is more of a character study disguised as an action film, in my opinion.
Yeah, The Blade a lot. I feel has a lot of those similar elements.
Yeah.
And the same way, it's difficult to talk about The Blade as being like, well, you gotta see like a classic Shaw Brothers movie. Like, not really. Yeah. Like, it's very artsy. Yeah. There's a lot of like playing with colors.
Yeah, and the camera work. I will say this, the camera work, the thing is, initially when I was like looking at the action scenes, it's like, this is one of the things that I wonder if this was done on purpose, because the camera work is, for the most part, kind of obscures the action. Like, it doesn't really...
You know what? Apparently for some of the scenes, they use a camera phone.
Really? And I wonder if that's... Okay, so this is why I wonder if this is like a budgetary thing. And because essentially with Choi Ha, he kind of did a similar thing in that, this is a budget thing, and we want to like shoot the action or to shoot the whole thing as if it was like sort of hectic documentary style.
Yeah, a cinema. Almost, reality, I remember.
Exactly. Very much like Jean-Luc Godard. And I wonder if that was Dev Patel's intent in shooting the action.
But Perhaps it was.
And then it kind of, you can see it as it progressed. You can see that the action was because most of the camera was somewhat out of sync with the movement, with the moving bodies. But then as you reach the final reel, the final showdown, the action, the camera work, you can tell there was a switch in terms of like the camera work is suddenly in tune with the moving bodies. And I wonder if that was an artistic choice that was interesting, but I wonder if that was like, it was using the sort of budgetary limitations, because there was a lot of limitations from what I understand during the shooting of this film.
It works.
It did work. It did work. And I think for me, because I had to like readjust my brain watching this film, I was like, no, this is clearly an artistic choice in terms of like showing the progression of the main character, and if I watch it purely from like a character study and as a form of essentially social commentary, it's such an interesting narrative film in that it's trying to, because you know, with action films it's very hyper masculine. It's to the point where it's a power fantasy, in that it essentially glorifies the anger of the hero, because what many action writers do is that they try to justify the anger of the main hero or his vengeance. It's like, yes, he has every right to be angry. This is why every action going moving forward in terms of like the mayhem he causes, or she, you know, is completely justified. In this film, I find it so interesting in that it doesn't take that route, and it uses the legend of Hanuman as a prime example, because okay, so let me just sort of rewind a bit, because I feel like, and this will contain spoilers. I'm sorry, I cannot talk about this film without really going into spoilers.
Oh no, please do not. I will disagree with that, because it's still in the theater. It's I think that would be unfair.
Oh,
I'm so sorry.
All right, okay.
The self-control.
All right, well, okay. I'm gonna carry on talking about it. But if I ended up doing any spoilers, you just have to like to stop me, Matt. That's all I can actually say. Okay, so I will try my best to step on eggshells. Oh, damn it, Matt. Okay, so essentially, I would say the first half of the film is very much a very typical action fare, in that it's about a main character wanting to avenge the death of his mother. That's the premise of the film. That's not a spoiler. That's the premise of the film.
No, it is the premise of the film, yeah.
So you can't take that away from it.
They don't give too much information, actually. Because also, one thing I want to say about me when I watched this movie is that I watched it in the Netherlands. So I didn't get any English subtitles
for the Indian dialogues. Yes. Yeah, I
did not have any information, because I read, start to understand a few words here and there in Dutch, but okay. I do not understand. So,
having
Dutch
said that,
well,
in that case, then do I? Because there are certain things I want to explain, and that will probably actually explain to the subtitles, because I know what you're talking about. Because there's a flashback scene where you see Neela, the mother of a kid, actually explaining something on the kid's hand, and I wonder if you understood the subtitles on that. Because that actually proves quite okay. I feel like I have to talk about that, because just so you can actually understand it.
Sure.
Okay. Cool. Okay. So the idea is that the first half of the film is essentially your typical revenge flick, but the kid loses, and he has to go through, a turning point in the middle of the film where he has to not embrace the anger or the sort of like the typical sort of like vengeance that basically he. For the first half of the film, he's looking for pain, because the pain is what fuels his pursuit to take down essentially the government or the corrupt regime that he's trying to take down. But he's not taking down the regime because it's actually corrupt. I mean, it is corrupt, but it's mainly for more personal reasons. And there's a switch in the middle of the film where he is essentially saved by a community
of trans women.
Or they call it the Hydra. If I pronounce it, so Hijra, Hydra community, which is essentially an umbrella term for people of transgender, intersex, or eunuchs. That term is. I only read that in Wikipedia, but that's what that umbrella term is, and it's essentially a community of transgender people who are essentially. Being pushed out by the government, because I think it's like in the film it posits a government is trying to cleanse India or the sort of cities from any of that specific community, and it's they do also hint
at some Islamophobia too. It's not just hints, like they're not sparkles, but like I do not think at any point. That's also one of the strengths of the movie, is that it doesn't try at any point to stop you and say, like, in 1952, this will happen. Like, you never have that. You always have things happen visually. And then
it's never hammered at the audience. It's very much a subtext of the actual film. But the Hydra community is represented by a character named Alpha, which is played by Vipin Sharma. Great character. Fantastic character. But it's essentially in that point on, it's essentially he goes through like essentially your kung fu training sequence, but it's also a moment of introspection where the kid has to remember who he is. And that's what that whole his hand with the flashback with the mother's hand is, that right. In the subtitles she explains that the lines on your hand are essentially what identify these are indicators of his roots or his origin as a person. And that is so interesting, because throughout the actual film, the kid's hands is actually scarred. They're essentially burnt scars now.
Right.
And because what the film posits is that, so he has forgotten about his origin through a traumatic event when he tried to save his mother. Again, I'm going to but it's not really a spoiler. No, but
I see what you mean.
Exactly.
So it's not very spoilerific, to be honest. I expected way worse, and I'm glad you're not going through that. But at the same time, I feel like everything is so is explained so visually in this movie that the important part is just me to go see it, because even if you're being told, like we just told you, like all those little plot elements, when you see them, it makes even more sense.
So much sense. You know, I had to really sort of think about it, because when I was watching it, I was like, that's really interesting. And how they actually, and I really loved how it's kind of like when you get that wonderful scene where Alpha explains, you know, like when he looks at like the kid's hands, and it's a very poignant scene. It's like fully aware that his hands are scarred. So look beyond the scars and you find that you as a person is still there. You just need to remember it. And that's such a beautiful moment. And I was like, this film really got me from a character and a narrative on a narrative level. And I also loved how it incorporated the legend of Hanuman. And I think a lot of people mistakenly thought that, Hanuman, that's like his superhero alter ego or whatever it's fucking called. And I would argue, because in the beginning, and I think it's actually not subtitled, but it's done through visual representation, because the legend of Hanuman is in the film, it posits that, Hanuman was essentially this monkey who woke up one morning and was like really fucking hungry, and he looks up and mistakes the sun for a piece of fruit, and he reaches up and tries to eat it, he does eat it, and consequently he's actually punished by the gods. That's what the introduction actually posits, and I think you kind of got that, even though you don't understand the subtitles. I think you would have got that through the visual elements.
You
reach the halfway point where the kid is actually saved by the Hydra community. And this is where you see those same images sort of like overlap with him being saved. And you realize, that fruit, he's not being punished. He's actually being saved by the gods. Because what that sun is, what that represents is, I would say, his ego. What he wants is like, impossible is that he thinks that he alone, with only vengeance only, that he can take down the corrupt regime, or essentially get his revenge through essentially just blind, angry violence. I don't know. That's a bad way of
What he means is like, that's the general gist of it. I think to be said about the movie is that it's all about finding strength, not just within yourself, within the community.
Exactly. And when the kid does attempt to essentially take down Rana in the first half of the film, his ass got handed to him. He's like on the verge of death, just like the monkey Hanuman, and he gets injured for it. And you know, because it's very much like the legend of Icarus, in that the sun like burns him, and he's actually injured because for him trying to reach this lofty and questionable ambition of his. And the gods in the reintroduction, where they try to punish him, is actually the gods, who are represented by the Hydra community, is actually they're trying to like put him together again. And I think there is actually another version of the legend where the gods, where Hanuman actually is burnt to ashes trying to eat the sun, and the gods actually gather around and gather all his ashes and reassemble his body.
Right.
And essentially that's what the Hydra community is actually doing in that very flashy sequence, and you could see that, you know, with the when they overlap the images. I was like, oh, So it's showing you, no, the gods aren't punishing him. They're trying to like fix him because he essentially punished himself by hurting himself by trying to pursue this, you know, again, this very bloodthirsty sort of revenge path that he actually put himself, that he placed himself in. And it was in that turning point where, when he says like, oh, you know, the whole idea of like, you have to remember who you are. Mm. It's essentially telling, remember who you are in terms of like, you can do more for the community. Like you said, you can do more for the community. It's about fighting for the people. You know, fighting the corrupt regime may be aligned with the people that are around you, the working class and the disenfranchised, but ultimately you're not really doing it for them. You're doing it for yourself for selfish reasons. That the whole idea of like, oh, vengeance is essentially, ultimately vengeance is a selfish act. And what the Alpha and the community is trying to show is that you don't go down this path, pursue. So your goal is still the same, but you have to like go about it a completely different way. And I love the fact that it literally subverts the whole glorifying fury by actually telling you, no, don't glorify fury. We are gonna like take down the regime, but it's gonna be for the greater good as opposed to more cathartic, vengeful reasons. And yeah. I was like, that's such an interesting way to subvert that action trope. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, absolutely. And it actually stops the film from becoming essentially another fridging story, because you know, the main character was actually seeking vengeance for the revenge for the death of his own mother. But by actually just sort of letting that go, it actually stops becoming that. And that's why I love it. I mean, yeah, he still gains a sense of semblance of peace, but that wasn't his main focus. You know, just like how he's not he befriends essentially a sex worker with a heart of gold, you know, kind of thing. And it's like, but he's not there to save the sex worker from, you know, from being
exploitation. Yeah,
exploitation. It never becomes like a power fantasy where, oh, the man has to save the woman from this, you know, heinous, you know, community or the CDA underground. So it never becomes that. And even then, the sex worker gains her own sort of autonomy.
Yeah, no, let's not give too much details though. But anyway, you're completely right, and I think that's even visually, and even though like some of those elements, because it was part of the explanations, I didn't get that. It was very understandable that even through just the visual lenses, how you progressively discover more of the context of how everything happens. Like the trauma disappears slowly, but also you understand more the general like reason of why this thing happened to him and his mother. And that it's not just like John Wick, where John Wick, he escapes from this life like of gangs and like the killing high killers community, and instead, when his dog dies, then he's reminded that he doesn't have his freedom. But it's like, okay, you're looking for your freedom, and that's cool. Like, I do enjoy the John Wick series. I think it's a solid series of movies, but they're all about just one man. Like, it's all about just his revenge and his quest for freedom. Was definitely what Dave Patel was trying to do with this movie. And I think that's also why they had problems with the production of this movie, because it addressed issues of corruption and homophobia, or transphobia, or Islamophobia that are definitely represented within the movie. All of those things are things that when he tried to produce the movie, he was asked, like, well, you probably should cut that because we don't want to get in any trouble.
Well, I think it's thanks to
Jordan Peele support that they got the movie out and the movie was done. He's actually, I think, doing a press tour with Jordan Peele, Dev Patel and Jordan Peele.
Yeah. For the most part, when I saw that in the beginning, I was like, hey, was Jordan Peele, like, how much was he involved? Was he the director? And then I read it and I read the production history of it. I was like, oh, that's why, because it was meant to like go straight to Netflix. I was like, no, Jordan was like, no, this is meant to go in the cinemas. In fact, I think it's having, not trouble, I think they're still going through a hurdle of like trying to release this film in India.
at the moment.
What a surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Because right?
The movie is very, very political and pointed in its political critique.
Absolutely.
And I think that's fantastic. It's also probably some of the best trans representation I've ever seen in a movie theater in recent years.
This is going to spoilers, but that final reel where the hijab community steps up. I feel like this movie
doesn't have enough publicity budget to be sold to as many people as it should, because it's still kind of like indie-ish. Especially compared to like the Godzilla vs. Kong, for example, that came out around the same time.
When I was in the cinema, I don't know how it was in your cinema, but it was not full. It was It was a real shame, but I mean, it's still getting there are eyes on it, but I wonder if it made back its budget at the very least, because I think it only cost like $10 million. Dollars to actually make, which is like super small for crying out loud.
This movie looks fucking gorgeous, and Dave Patel is his first directorial debut. This is amazing. This is a great movie. It's a great movie for any director, let alone for a first movie.
Very little indication of like doing action in films. I don't know. To be honest, I haven't seen Green Knight, so I wonder how much action did he do.
There isn't that much action kind of thing. It's comparable to Monkey Man in the sense that there's a sort of fable element to it. Green Knight, 100%. Monkey Man is a bit of a fable in some sense. So. Like in the way that it's a very large adventure and like there's a kind of like soul searching element, perhaps. I don't know if that probably doesn't qualify enough a movie to be considered a fable, but there is a bit of comparison you could make between the two, I would say. But regardless, he's just stars in The Green Knight. He's like, it's not.
Yeah.
He's just acting in it. He's beautiful. He's fantastic in it. But here he really handles so much and does it with such intelligence and taste. It's so smart. Such a great movie.
You can tell that he's a very, clearly from what I've seen and like based on like, he's a very mindful storyteller.
Yeah, 100%.
So I'm very impressed. And like I said, you know, if I was to judge this purely on an action front, I would say, arguably, it wasn't what I was looking for. But at the same time, it wasn't trying to sell it to me to begin with. It was, do you know what I mean?
It's a strange movie to recommend to people.
Yeah, like, as an action film. Okay, so...
In the Netherlands, at least in Amsterdam, the cinema we went to see the Monkey Man, on the side of the cinema, they always have those huge ass posters for big action releases. And so generally it's the film that they're really trying very hard to push through. And we always joke about it, probably middle-aged men, like dads, or like really trying to, do you want to see some action, Sherlock? This is what we got. So they had like Expendables 4 there.
That's a thing.
That's right. They had Expendables 4 on the side. And then they had like The Beekeeper, you know, with Jason Statham as a, I guess, a beekeeper. Like, with guns.
I saw the trailer of that and it looked like
terrible. But they also had a poster for Monkey Man.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait, like, you're trying to sell to the same people you tried to sold Expendables 4 and The Beekeeper? Monkey Man?
Yeah.
This is not gonna connect with that audience, or at least it might, but like not to the level that they're expecting something similar. Because there are action scenes and they're very well done, and he does a competent job of being a fighter. Mm. However, this isn't really the point.
No, not at all. You're essentially going back to The Blade. You're trying to sell The Blade as an action film. It's a wuxia film, a sword blade film.
It's a very artsy wuxia film.
That's the thing. I mean, Okay, so this is why I was like, I checked out a couple of interviews, and Dev Patel said he was also inspired by South Korean cinema, namely A Better Sweet Life. And when I first heard it, in my head, I was like, that makes sense, because I'd be hesitant to call that an action film in itself, because it's not really an action film. Exactly. It's a drama.
It's a drama with a huge action finale, but it's a drama.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's what essentially Monkey Man is in terms of like the composition. I was like, oh, that's the composition that you're trying to, that's your riffing on. And yeah, there are some Hong Kong elements, namely the training sequence with there's a sequence where he's holding two buckets of water like Gordon Liu in 36 Chambers of Shaolin. You know, I was like, oh yeah, I could see that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And there's the mirror scene in the final reel that's very like Enter the Dragon, which. You know, I can take it or leave it. To be honest with you, I got more excited when, it's the more visceral when he finally does get his, when he punches Rana, essentially the main fighting heavy, I guess, if you want to call it that, you know, in the film.
There's a bit of the protector too, I felt, because there's a bit of a tower progression, the way kind of like...
Oh, the Game of Death. Kind of element,
that's definitely. All stuff.
Yeah, and there's definitely that, but it's very much again. I think that what essentially Dev Patel did was like he took those particular platform and it's essentially a platform and decided, okay, what can I do with it in terms of my own sensibility. And
yeah, he's really trying to tell his own story, and I feel like that's what's really amazing with this movie is that it's his first. It's his directorial debut, and he really focused on one single thing, not making a genre movie or try to fit expectations, but just saying something that he cared about. And I feel like that should be supported regardless,
but 100%.
Like, even more when it's a fucking great movie.
It's the most expensive cinema ticket I've actually paid in a long time.
God, that was nonsense.
I sent you the text. It was like, 60 quid, wow, because I last time I watched the film in the cinema was the Spider-Verse sequel, but in like Peck and Plex, where it was only a fiver. I was like, and I literally forgot
that's the price of a movie. 60 quid, that's a week of food.
I know, but you know, hey, I'm showing my fucking support, so it's like,
no,
I
but
think
that's true, but like, yeah, I'm not saying you shouldn't pay for this. I'm just saying, like, cinemas, what's wrong with you? Because like, if you have to choose between a week of food or going to the movies, like, this is not like,
I know,
a good choice.
I mean, this is what I guess it was my vicarious moment. Is that the word I'm looking for? Anyway, but yeah, it's. I highly recommend the film. Although I will recommend it with an asterisk in that if you're going in there expecting an Indian John Wick as if it was like sold on that, don't. Like, don't do that.
Watch Triple R at home. If you want to see some good action Indian movie, watch Triple R. It was amazing.
Yeah,
but
this is
slightly different.
Yeah, like, and you good. Know, and you know what, I think, like I said, Dev Patel is a very mindful sort of director/storyteller, because there was a moment where there was a nod towards John Wick where he was trying to buy a gun.
Say, oh, it's the same gun as John Wick.
Yeah, and it's like, you can look at Dev Patel's face or the kid's face where it's like, yeah, I'm not doing that. Give me something that is my own kind of thing.
You know
and
what made
like,
me laugh in that scene is that I saw this and I thought, you know what, that's probably how most people who sell guns probably sell their guns, and being like, this is from this movie. As seen in The Terminator.
Yeah.
You see the effect. Like, no, you haven't. This movie. Like, it's not the same thing. But I can easily see this as being a selling point, as being like, oh, this gun is the same thing as this. You will enjoy it very much.
Alright. Cheers. I do generally hope that Dev Patel sticks with the action space. I don't know if he will, and I don't know if he wants to, and you know, that's his choice ultimately, but I personally do hope he sticks with it, because I can generally see him take it further in terms of composition. It's like, okay, well, maybe in the next week, maybe he will be more action heavy in terms of the spectacle, the moving body, and
because there's definitely some really interesting things that happen in this movie that felt like, oh,
and he's
you know what you're doing.
And he's a very interesting mover. I like, because if you look at his stature compared to most action heroes, he cuts a very fine figure, but compared to like your normal sort of action hero, he's a very slight, thin figure. He's quite tall. I think he's actually very tall, but he's a very slight figure. He's not overly, he's muscular, but he's very much like the Bruce Lee sort of like wiry type.
I mean, you know, that's the thing. He looks more like classic action stars rather than the contemporary ones where they make them bulk up so much.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
And also, there must be fucking insufferable for those actors to do all that training for nothing. I mean, for a movie, like, that's cool. But, like, after that, the thing is, the actor was in the Eternal, and Kumail Nanjiani. The fact that he had to bulk up for that role and like how hard it was. And then after that, he kind of has continued sort of to have that figure. But like he completely changed from one, like, because I knew him as a comedian.
Me too.
Like it was like
you know, Silicon Valley.
Guy. It was cool.
Silicon Valley and then he's type. Like, yeah.
What are you doing? Like, okay, that's nice if that's what you want, but is that really desirable? Let's not do that. So I was really happy that Dev Patel didn't go for like changing his figure too much to be like sort of ready for a role. When it's like you don't need to, like, action people and don't need to look like contemporary, like bulking up monsters.
And the thing is, it probably wouldn't work for the film as well, because it's kind of like, where you're getting all the protein in this, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Also, why is he not big and super effective at the beginning in the ring? He's so bulky. Yeah. Like,
oh, there was like, I don't know, maybe this was going to be spoilers, but there was a moment in the chase sequence that actually brought out a laugh. I think you know what I was talking about when he attempts his escape.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I felt that because that was in the trailer. For me, it was the only time where I was like, that's a bit of a forced joke. I didn't think it was that funny, but also probably because I'd seen it in the trailer. And even in that moment, I felt like, seems off. Is this really what this movie is about? Like action scenes and a bit of physical.
But I think it kind of, I thought it worked for me, because again, it's Dev Patel trying to like subvert the whole, oh, the spectacular body doing extraordinary things. It's like, no, there are moments where he won't be able to do extraordinary things. And, you know, you have to understand that precedes a scene where he gets his ass handed to him by the main character. So he's not meant to be. It worked with the overall composition, which I actually really appreciated, because if he did end up jumping through the window, smashing through the glass window, it would seem a bit too much for that particular scene.
But it's more the physical comedy you expect from Ryan Gosling when he does action movies or action roles, because he's a really good, he's really funny.
He is really funny, and I think there is a wry sense of humor somewhere in the actual film, but like I said, given the nature of the film and the story it's trying to tell, he didn't push it to that level, and I think sensibly so. Thumbs up as a straight sort of narrative and character piece, total thumbs up. Don't go in there expecting Indian John Wick, for the love of God.
I think there will also be a turn off for some people when it's like, no, that you should go in watching the movie, because I feel like Indian John Wick is such a bad way to sell it. For whoever think that is the case, but I do not think that's appealing.
And it
just means like it's a rehash. It's like, no,
it's a rehash, a derivative of that franchise, and it's not derivative, it's its own thing. And I understand. I hate it, but I also understand why they would market it, because you know, like that, because it's like it's a buzzword. You know, it's a way to get people bums on seats, and you know, John Wick at this point is a proven commodity or brand, if you want to call it that. If you want to get kind of gross with it, so. But at the same time, it's not that, but you should appreciate it on its own. Merits, because it has a lot of merits.
Exactly. 100%. Speaking of another movie who has a lot of merit, Taxi Hunter.
That's your hunter. The main focus. Yeah. Well, we're about 15. Yeah, we're about an hour in. So yeah, that's just about right. Taxi Hunter, released in 1993, starring Anthony Wong Tao Sun as Kim, Yu Rong Guan as Yu Kai Chang, and Athena Chu as Maxi Yan, Manda as Maxi Gao, who essentially is the father of Anthony Chu's character. And
in one of the most out of place character of I've ever seen, and yet one of the best character of this movie. I love them so much, and yet I cannot believe this man at any point.
This guy's a cop, you know.
Is he Dennis the Menace that's been hired and they still let him in going like, look, this is fine.
It's kind of like, how can he pass his physical? No offense to my dad as an actor, but Jesus Christ.
There's so much questions about this character. So there's basically him and Rong Gong Yu, could both do like, I could see one good season of a cop show with those two.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah.
Because it's like, hey, I'm a badass cop. I play on the rules.
Oh, and the one that fumbles all the time. Oh, there you go again.
The other guy is like, hey, I wear the Chicago Bulls merch all the time. I have a spray that I use in my mouth all the time because apparently my breath stinks. And I offer a random woman to go see a blue movie out of nowhere. Like, and the woman is like, haha, cheeky. It's like, could you imagine trying to date someone and be like, so do you like to see some porn together? Like, that's not
I finally got my Blu-ray for Showgirls. You want to check it out? I was like, no, thank you.
You know what? Actually, that's slightly more enticing. Okay. Depending on the audience, that's slightly more enticing.
Probably,
some people would be appealed, but like, as a first, like, what are you talking about? And, yeah, so this guy is out of just so good. Fantastic. I love him. He justifies watching this movie. Like, I'm gonna say out of the blue, just for him you can watch this and enjoy it.
I would say RIP for Manda, because he passed away a good few years ago. But yeah, known as one of the best character actors Hong Kong generation.
And he's shouting soccer, he did a lot of stuff.
He's a regular comedic partner to Stephen Chow, so they always do like films, comedy films. Yeah, he often plays the weird, perverted, uncool type. But he actually has proven to be a really good actor in places. So I think he got his first best supporting actor role award in the role A Moment of Romance, directed by Benny Chan, which again, RIP. They're all going away, Matt.
I want to give
a special mention to another actress, Perry Lai Hoi San, who doesn't get a name but essentially plays Kim's wife. And I think you've seen this lady before,
right?
Have you seen Hardboiled? Right,
I have. Yeah.
You know,
of
the
library. I've seen Hardboiled. I even got a T-shirt with Hardboiled on it.
You know the librarian who same actress.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great. I haven't seen her in a lot of films, but I was like, oh yeah, I know this lady. So yeah. So synopsis, Taxi Hunter. You know what, I wrote the synopsis, but you wrote one as well, but I think they're more or less the same one. So do you want to go or shall I go?
Oh yeah, I'm very happy with my synopsis.
Yeah, go on.
So Kin, played by Anthony Wong, is an office worker at an insurance company. Life is good. But he's a very calm person, which makes him an easy prey for the toxic masculinity on display in the streets of early 90s of Hong Kong. One night, when his pregnant wife is about to give birth, he tries to get a taxi because public healthcare can't provide him with a free ambulance and privatization is a scourge. His wife ends up in an accident. She soon passes away along with the baby, a piece of news delivered by the doctor the same way as he would have announced that they had to remove a kidney. Left alone, Kin's rage and resentment build up, and he turns his hate to all taxi drivers. They're all exploitative scumbags and they need to die. That's it. That's an hour and a half of the movie.
And
it's just great.
It's great. It's amazing.
If you're a taxi driver, on the other hand, do not watch this movie because it's not going to like this.
It's funny because this film came about, pretty much came out, let's say, around the time where Hong Kong Taxis was getting a lot of stick from the Hong Kong public, because there were actually reports of essentially bad behavior from taxi drivers. They were coming under fire for all sorts of reasons, such as rude behavior, levying illegal surcharges, such as bad weather or even like untidiness. And there are often cases of taxi drivers refusing to take people for short distances, because obviously they're not going to be earning that much for short distances. At the time that, you know, taxi drivers was getting a lot of bad rap in the press and essentially the Hong Kong public, and this film only really feeds into that. There's actually no nuance.
There's one.
There's one good taxi driver in there, and you know what? I love the fact that they actually showed that scene, because when these films, in terms of like character stories, you tend to like see the main character, they go, when they begin their sort of rampage, it's often a blind rampage. Mm. They often like kill. They basically throw a really wide net. And it doesn't matter, you know, who he catches, as long as it's that specific type of people, aka the taxi drivers, he's fine. But in this case, compared to like the other characters that Anthony Wong plays, where they often go a violent rampage, he doesn't. He clearly is grief stricken. He's clearly mentally unstable. But at his core, he's a good person. Like,
he's a kind-hearted person. Like, well, he has a strong moral standard.
Yeah,
basically, he's got a strong standard. Moral compass.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like when he's like sitting in the taxi, and the taxi driver is like willing to like take him from one end of Hong Kong to the other. It's like, hey, you know, you're gonna say yes to this? Like, yeah, I mean, it's a job. I was like, oh, you know what? Here's some money. You're clearly a good guy. I'm not gonna do anything to you. And the taxi driver's like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, clearly not in the know.
You missed the bullet right now, and you don't know. Yeah. You don't even know.
Yeah, exactly. But having said that, for the most part, wow, you know, he really, and most of these, I don't know, dare I say, some of these killings are kind of justified, aka the attempted rapists scene. It's like, that was like, I mean, I don't know if there were any cases of attempted rape in Hong Kong, but you know, that scene would like,
yeah, but that clearly, taxi driver, like, yeah, that, obviously that, like, probably that was scene, a bunch.
Yeah, that scene was definitely there to rile up some emotions in right, so
yeah, and exactly, like, but that's the thing, is that the main point I want to make about this movie, about its subject matter. So when I started watching it, in my head, it just hit me, and I was like, oh, I've never seen Taxi Driver. Because Taxi Hunter, Taxi Driver.
Yeah.
Let's
not get confused. The Martin Scorsese film, just some of you don't know. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then, so after that, I watched Taxi Driver. But also, during the interview with Anthony Wong, they mentioned that the movie Falling Down Michael Douglas came out. Yeah, and Joel Schumacher directed it. Came out the same year. It was also a 1983 movie. So I also watched that. And I have to say, the main thing with this movie, because you said about this particular scene showing us, or at least making us side with Anthony Wong in the case of, well, sometimes perhaps this extreme violence maybe is sort of justified. The main thing with Taxi Hunter is that it's an exploitation movie about a vigilante taking on his task of revenge by taxi killing people. But this movie really sides with him 100%.
Oh, totally.
Compared to like Taxi Driver and Falling Down, where it's very obvious that both directors despise their main characters. They're really just like, no, those people are scumbags.
Yeah.
Emmanuel really just went like, no, I agree, let's kill all taxi drivers. It's not a movie with...
When you give a kid a Dragon Ball Shiny card, you have a heart of gold, I don't care what you say or do, you are a good person. That's what it's trying to say.
Okay, this is the moment that he won me over. On the other hand, like I was the like, oh yeah, no, he's 100%. You can kill all taxi drivers or whatever he was. He just gave a shiny to this kid who wanted a shiny car for Dragon Ball Z. Like, go, like, you know me, like I'm Anthony Wong. Just yeah, like you know my heart.
Team Anthony, I'm Team Anthony.
But otherwise, yeah, the thing also that makes you side with him is that the fact that there's so much toxic masculinity, like, on display everywhere.
Yeah.
So, at the beginning, so his wife dies, but then he has to return to work.
Yeah. But,
and then his boss is like, oh, your productivity is down. Well, yeah, motherfucker, his wife died and he's lost grieving. His child.
He's grieving. Of course
his productivity is down, when you speak. But, never mind. So the brother, his brother-in-law, doesn't seem to grieve too much for his sister, but also doesn't really care too much for him. And even at some point when he's being offered like, oh, we're going to dinner, do you want to come? And he's like, no, I can't because I have to see a friend. He's a bit upset. Like, upset?
Yeah. A bit upset?
Maybe it's subtitles, maybe it's the translation of poor choice of word, but upset is the word I would use if you told me, like, oh, I couldn't see the movie today, I had a bit of a headache, so I'm
couldn't
upset.
See Monkey Man.
Exactly, I couldn't see the movie, I couldn't see Monkey Man, I'm upset. My wife just fucking died. Being a bit more than upset. But so he's completely, like, the grief is completely ignored by everybody. And he's like, okay, maybe taking a gun and taking revenge. Because the only time where he's being applauded is when, again, toxic masculinity, he shows up and I think he punches a taxi driver, like he defends someone, and you're like, yeah, that is not the decision that should be applauded for. Like, that guy wasn't right, but that is not necessarily a good way to solve the issue. So, but yet, Anthony Wong sells this role.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well.
Totally.
Doesn't matter. Yeah, I'm in 100%.
Yeah,
the script is so thin, but he gave so much to this character.
Like, he elevates the material. I think, and I have to give props to Hermin Yao for allowing. Oh, nuances essentially. I mean, yes, it's very one-sided, granted, but still nuances, because you're essentially adding complexity to the exploitative elements that is on display, because you're using what you already know from your previous film, which is Untold Story, which is like a full-on category 3 film, and you're essentially taking those elements and putting it in this film, and it's like, and questioning, well, is violence really the answer when you're pushed to the brink? Because, you know, the Kin character is, like you said, a kind-hearted person who's essentially pushed to the brink, and it's like he has actually no outlet for his emotions. No. And yeah, that's what, and I find that that's what most people go through when they resort to violent outbursts, is that because they just have no outlet for their
need for revenge, for their frustration.
Or for their frustration, yeah, exactly. And I think that's, and you know, it's a very, even though this film's from like the early 90s, I think it would still work today. I think it does still work today.
As an exploitation movie, yeah, it does. Yeah, it would probably be a bit more sleazy, I think, if it was done today, to make it even more extreme. Because that's the thing. Although most taxi drivers in the movie are a bit scummy, I think to really, really justify completely the fact that Anthony Wong starts killing them, they probably would have to give them a bit more than that, because aside from the rapist guy, like, most of them, like, because you listed things at the beginning to say, yeah, at the time taxi drivers were like making a mess, overcharging, and I don't know what else, refusing to go to certain places. Yeah, that's taxi driver all the time.
Yeah, like, it's true.
I'm sorry.
Although, let's, I mean, you glossed over
them, but like, there's a bunch, and that doesn't justify killing them.
Yeah.
So... although, I will say this, you glossed over the death of his wife. And, you know, I have to say, that entire sequence God. Was horrible. I mean, just arguably up there with the other, like the more like Ebola syndrome and untold story.
It's graphic though.
It's not super graphic, but it's horrific at how she like literally dragged across the road.
And the guy doesn't stop. He's like, I could care less.
Yeah, I'm like. I think it's like, you know, she's pregnant as well. That makes the whole scene so much worse and fucked up.
This movie sighs 100% with getting sexy drivers. Like, that's the thing. Like, and
it's funny because we did mention the killing of the attempted rapist. But I will say, in terms of like pure visceral violence, that scene was. Really hit that note, because for the most part it's actually quite, it's not as visceral is not the right word, but it doesn't reach that height ever for the rest of the film. It's still a great film, but it never hits that note ever again, and I know why, because they wanted to show something really horrible to really justify Kin's grief throughout the actual rest of the film.
The other thing with this scene is that he plays it so calm.
Yeah.
That's probably the moment that could easily justify Anthony Wong acting a bit more angrily and just trying. But he goes full on psychopath and just be like,
he's quietly
not very nice.
You know
Would
what?
You appreciate that? Like, his whole rhetoric, like, it makes 100% sense, because he's basically saying, like, would you do that? Like, do you not have any respect for a woman? And I'm like, 100% agreed. But he does with a gun in his hand, and then he starts shooting the guy's knees.
See, I actually do like Anthony Wong's approach, because normally when you portray quote-unquote crazy person, or someone who on the verge of, you know, essentially on a mental breakdown, the easy way out is to make him or her go absolutely crazy and go on a screaming rampage. In this film, I like the fact that he is going through a mental breakdown because through grief, but he does it quietly, in that he actually develops his own internal logic that doesn't make sense whatsoever in the larger grand scheme of things, but he still follows that, because that's what pulls him from point A to point B, because he believes this is the right thing to do. I believe this is the right thing to do. It's never like I'm gonna kill everyone. It's never on like a screaming rabbit. It's never out of control. He actually has his own internal logic. As absolutely batshit crazy it is, it's still an internal logic that you.
Well, there's layers to that, because for example, Michael Douglas in Falling Down, like, he acts. He does get angry. Like, he does use his baseball. He does pick up a baseball bat at the beginning of the movie, and then starts bashing things in a supermarket.
Yeah.
And starts being racist to the Korean owner of that supermarket. So, although he still has what you just described, kind of a moral compass, has an internal logic that doesn't really make sense, but justifies everything for him to get to point A to point B. He does get a bit angry. Like, he raises his voice. Anthony Wong barely raises his voice. Like, he's that level of creepy polite that makes him even more of a threat. Because it's like, he's still nice.
I don't even want to call it creepy, because it just, it's more, it's, yeah, there's some, it, it's, there's something, there's a, insidious? I don't know. Creepy brings a different imagery in my.
Creepy for me works just because when you kindly or very politely start shooting people and killing them, there is a bit of a.
It's very.
There's something wrong with you.
it's very a matter of fact. I think that's what makes it.
It is very matter of fact. That's for sure. Yeah. And that is like the cold. He's not a cold, calculated killer.
No,
he's an accountant, and he still takes care of things.
He's
an insurance. Yeah, sorry, he's an insurance, but he really is very matter of fact in how he treats things.
He's and very pragmatic. Also,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's also why the end when he reaches, like, there's a kind of like point of no return, and the cop basically appeals to him saying, like, that's against the law. And I'm like, at first I was like, well, that's the worst argument you could ever make to somebody about not killing people. It's like, it's against the law. I think there's more of a moral argument. Yeah. However, for Anthony Wong character, it makes complete sense that he would just be told that's against the law, because that's kind of the stuff, like the moral element. It's like, yeah, but that's, no, I have a different moral standard. So telling him off instead that's against the law, that feels a bit more to him.
I remember that sort of back and forth dialogue, because it is Yuron Guang that actually says that. Yeah. And I think it does make the case where, well, no one captured my wife's killer. You know, where's my wife's killer? And, you know, to be fair, even at the end of the film, I don't think I think that's left still unsolved. You know, they never really did find the killer.
And to be fair, about that,
No, and it's just the taxi driver that did kill the wife. It's just some faceless, you know, ignorant sort of taxi driver that we probably would forget. You know, and I did actually forget who killed his wife again. You know, they never.
I don't remember his face either. He never comes back in the movie, as far as I know. Maybe he has kind of a role, because the thing also with this movie that's perhaps also very interesting and important to highlight is that was shot in 20 days.
Yeah. And there's That's a lot of, complex stuff. Like, you discussed it on your notes that, you know, Yuron Guang leapt on top of a moving taxi.
That action scene in the beginning, Jesus.
I mean, I'm not surprised and kind of glad, because Yuron Guang is known to doing action films. I mean, he's been in some of, like, classics, mostly playing bad guys, to be fair. But I mean,
I can see that
he's got
a bit of a stern face.
He does. He really does. He's probably most famous for the film Iron Monkey, which is a classic waifu kung fu film.
Suyak, right?
Choi Hark produced it, but Yuen Woo-ping directed it, and also starring Donnie Yen. And it's like, I would say top five favorite.
I've never seen Iron Monkey. I really need to change.
You should watch. I think you will like it. I feel
it's gonna be on the list.
It will be in our watch list. But yeah, Yuron Guang known to be doing action, and I wonder if that it was just Herman Yao being like,
oh,
let's get you to, yeah, do, you know, let's widen our appeal and then, like, add in this action element.
I think because that's probably how we did this movie, because he also asked Anthony Wong just a few, like, the reason Anthony Wong is in this movie is that apparently Herman Yao basically went up to him and is like, do you have time in your schedule? And he was like, well, that's great, because I just got turned down by something, so I got, like, a couple of weeks. And then they did the movie. So, like, there was no big overarching logic for Anthony Wong to be like, oh, I really want to play this character. It's more of, like, an opportunity rather than anything else. And also, you pointed at the beginning that Herman Yao leaves a lot of room for Anthony Wong to develop the character. Yeah. The other thing that Anthony Wong points out in the interview is that when he's being asked, he's like, oh, did Herman Yao give you pointers? And his reply is like, he doesn't give me pointers because I don't pretend to be a director. So he's not an actor, so he leaves me with my stuff. He suggests things, I don't listen to him. I'm like, all right. I mean, they work very well together, so I saw they work. But
I saw your notes on the interview for Anthony Wong, and I just couldn't stop laughing, because that's just Anthony Wong all over. He's fantastic. He's such a fucking rebel. I think at one point when he did get, like, he finally got, like, a Best Actor Award or Best Supporting Actor Award, after getting it, he literally, like, threw it in the bin and gave, like, the paparazzi a middle finger. I was like, I didn't give a fucking shit. He's
Honestly, in the interview, I think when he's being asked, I can't remember, I think he's being asked about his method or like, he's being asked about if he thinks that the movie resonated with a Hong Kong audience so that they were trying to say something that like most people in Hong Kong were thinking.
Was he like, I don't give a shit?
Exactly, but he's like, no, I don't have that much, that big of an ego. And he actually finishes by saying that we're all wankers anyway. I'm like, fantastic. Love this man.
He has a similar interview etiquette in the interview for the Beast Cops DVD. it's just so funny. It's like, he gives like really short, curt answers. Like, yeah, it's all right. You know, I was like, I don't care. You know,
he's a plumber. He doesn't look at the craft as being like, oh, this is an amazing thing. He's like, no, I just do this, and that's
he
it.
He just does
like,
it. But he's also, but that not to dismiss his craft, because he clearly does. Because it went in the Beast Cops interview. He literally, I'm not kidding. He begins the interview with segment from King Lear, like literally goes on full on fucking Shakespeare, and then starts it. Okay, let's see. I could turn it on whenever I want, basically.
This movie really deserves to be picked up on Blu-ray, like the 80th film edition.
Please.
Pick it up, if only for the bonuses. Like, you will enjoy this. Definitely watch the bonuses after watching the movie. The movie is great. But really just the bonuses, the interviews, he's so good. And I think that was a brilliant, brilliant idea to get him to talk about that role and his career in general. Because, he's very interesting. But also, the man, I could listen to the man for hours. He's so fun and so entertaining.
I think he has
that kind of Cage thing to him. Like, Nicolas Cage also has that thing in interview.
Very much so. Like, that Nicolas Cage thing. And, you know, I love Nicolas Cage, much to the dismay of some of my friends. Yeah, fantastic man. I love him as an actor, as a man, as an individual. And because he's so, I think he's very much like Anthony Wan, largely because he's very much self-aware of his own image. And he doesn't give a shit about it. He knows in a way.
No, completely. Apparently, in the interview, he hints that a lot of people still ask him about Taxi Hunter, and he's a bit bitter about it, saying, like, as if I have not done any other movies in my career. But he's like, he doesn't have any problem with the movie. It's more of a, like, I've done other things. Like, and he's got such a large career. Like,
he has a large career. I think it's largely, I think it's a combination of, because Anthony Wong, as an actor, for the longest time, he's considered someone in the industry as someone who's a very, very good actor, but has no commercial appeal. And I think there's an element of him not being bitter about it, but he's aware that, this is my space, and it took me a while to actually get to the point where I am, where I am respected for my craft.
Mm.
And I think, and also it's coupled with the fact that his mother is Hong Kong, but his father is Australian, and I think there's a racial bias towards him for the longest in the industry.
Wasn't there a BBC documentary about him? Because he at least a cover of it, because he met some of his relatives from Australia.
He
had no clue he had brothers, other brothers.
Yeah,
and they had no clue about him, and they were like, "Wait, you're an actor?" And I'm like, "Yeah." That's incredible.
You're right. There was a BBC coverage because it was essentially them reuniting. I don't know if it's reunited because they never met before, didn't they? So it was really interesting, and I think he has mellowed out recently, but generally speaking, he's considered kind of like the bad boy of Hong Kong cinema, in that he doesn't necessarily play by the rules.
Yeah, I would call him an actor's actor. That's the thing. He's like, I'm sure every actor is like, oh shit, I'm playing with Anthony Wong, that's amazing. And he's like, yeah, that's cool, but like, you're still the lead and I'm still the side character. Like, that's not cool.
I mean, there is an element, and I think he knows, he's fully aware, and unfortunately that is the case, that Hong Kong cinema can be incredibly vapid and very overly commercial in its, in the way they put out talent.
Yeah, and he's never been like a big success outside of Hong Kong cinema, or at least he's done stuff. Like he's in a British TV show that's called, I think, White Dragon. It's called something else in another country, but he's in
I think, but he's mostly the face of the category three films, because that's that's what he's, you know, most known for.
So good in everything else.
He is so good in anything, but I think it's just a case of, you know, you don't choose your, as an actor, you don't choose your successes, unfortunately.
Yeah,
it's really the audience that chooses it for you. And if you're known by that specific, even a small segment of your filmography, even to this day, then, you know, that's it. I mean, I get Anthony Wong's sense, but at the same time, it is what it is, I'm afraid. And I love Anthony Wong 100%.
He's part of the triumvirate of like Johnny Two actors.
Yeah. Because totally.
Like find again. It's the 1986 one. Yeah. No, it's not the 1986
one. You're thinking about the Ultimate, the Mission.
Yeah, exactly.
1999.
Yeah, with so it's Anthony Wong, Stuart Lamstuart, and Simon Yam. It's like that's the dream period. Like those three in any Johnny Two movies, they're always fantastic.
Yeah.
And for me he's part of that trio. Well again, Simon Yam and Lamstuart, both of them such underrated actors. Just such a fucking nightmare to think. Like those guys are not recognized as much as they should, because they always nail every part, like whatever they're doing. It's like, just give them the role and they'll fucking rock it. And they don't get any end of praise, really. But going back to Anthony Wong in his role, he really, really brings out some really, really great stuff. And there's a bit, he does a bit of a De Niro thing when there's the moment where
he's practicing
training
how
himself.
To pull, when he practices to pull out the gun from his trousers, he doesn't really have a hoister, doesn't he?
It's definitely a nod to Taxi Driver, but it never feels like he's doing an impression.
No.
And that's also testament to how good he is, because it's an easy thing. Like even in like Mathieu Kassovitz, that end, there's a bit like this where I can't remember, it was Vincent Cassel who's trying to do the you talking to me bit.
Yeah.
And it's more obvious that this is exactly Taxi Driver. Whereas in Taxi Hunter, it's not as obvious. Like, you can see from the way the scene is shot and from like its role within the plot, but he's not doing the Niro impression. He's not trying to be the Niro. He's just trying to be himself, and he's very awkward at it.
He's not trying to be himself. He's trying to test out a personality that he's not.
Yes.
He's not used to, because he's so, like you said, he's so mild mannered and kind hearted.
Yeah, he's trying to find his tone, own tone.
Exactly.
And that's,
he's trying to be.
He reworks.
Yeah, exactly. He's trying to find a way to how do I be aggressive? How do I be threatening? And it's like that's not a muscle he's used to using, and that for him to exercise that muscle and somewhat fumble is such an interesting watch.
Yeah, no, he's really perfect in that role, because he can be aggressive. I mean, I've seen Out of the World. He's amazingly aggressive in this one. He's such like the consummate bad guy. He's like in Hardball, he's such a bad guy that even other bad guys within the movie are like, you went too far.
I don't know, man.
He's not stopping. And in Taxi Hunter, he's such a more grounded guy, just very reserved. And like, I'm gonna kill people today because that's my revenge.
You know what? I think the scene that really. Really, like for me, it was like the highlight. It's like he literally went into the hospital purely so he can apologize to my dad's character. for like trying to kill him. I was like, I thought you were a taxi driver, so that's why I tried to kill you, but turns out you're not, so I'm sorry, can you just like not chase me again?
Yeah,
and it's like, that's like the worst thing you could do is actually literally go to the police and like put yourself in a position where you're gonna get seen and potentially caught. And that's why I love it, because the whole idea of an internal logic is that he follows his own internal logic, by that led a lot by his own sort of moral compass, but it backfires completely because you know that, oh, he's gonna go to the police and apologize, and that's gonna do something in terms of escalate the situation. And oh, and it really does, because he holds Anthony Chu's character hostage, who's the daughter.
Yeah, but he only sees the way he sees taxi drivers is the way racist people look at people who are not white. Like, it's like, they're all bad. Like, he's just like, so when he sees that, oh, you are an exception, I didn't mean to hurt you. Like,
I can't do this, I'm what? Sorry. No. Yeah.
Isn't that the wake-up call? Like, oh, yeah. No, it's not, okay.
Well, it's not the wake-up call, but at the same time, you can't...
Not. Not at all.
No, but you can't, at the same time, you can't really call the kid character as someone who goes on a blind animalistic rampage as his character where in Ebola Syndrome, where he literally kills and, you know, sexually assaults anyone left, right, and center. You know, it's nothing carnal about it. It's
very reasonable.
Yes.
In a non-reasonable way.
Reasonable in the spectrum of killing people or vigilantism.
I wanted to talk a bit more about Taxi Driver also, and actually about Falling Down, because I think there's with Taxi Hunter they form an interesting trio of movies.
Yeah,
they're all very different, but they all have something to say about the city that they're set in. Like, the thing I really enjoy about Taxi Hunter is that it's an hour and a half movie shot in 20 days, so you have a really, really a lot of scenes of Hong Kong and the city and the streets, and it really does give you an idea of what is the point of view of what the city is like. And it's
the pressures of city life and the mental toll it takes on...
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's what makes them comparable to both Falling Down, which is like an LA movie, and All Venice Beach, and like Taxi Driver, which is the consumer New York movie of that era.
Where
they have also similar color saturation in the street scenes, so they have that kind of like dreamlike element of where whenever you're in the street, that's it, like anything can happen. And and that at least in Taxi Driver and Taxi Hunter, Falling Down is much more grounded in that sense, but they both have that really very much like murky thing of like whatever is gonna happen tonight, we don't know. And those two are really super interesting. But I really want to come back to the fact that I found really super funny, but also like that's the only warning I would have about this film, is that how much Herman Yao seems to really side with this character. It's such a right-wing movie, because it's
super
like,
one-sided.
Yeah,
super one-sided.
Taxi Driver is so much of a like, okay, there's scumbags everywhere, but like that's the worst way you could go around of solving problems. And Taxi Driver is 100% a litmus test in any relationship. If you ask someone, how do you feel about the character of Travis Bickle? If the person answers by, I really like him, I think he had the right idea, then you fucked up. You should get away very far from that person.
Red flag.
Because Scorsese and De Niro definitely didn't like Travis Bickle. Like, it's very obvious that they despise him.
There's definitely, like, they call it shades of grey, but it's not really shades of grey.
No, it's not. It does somewhat some good action. Like, that's not really the case. Like, yeah. At the end, he sort of saves someone. Sort of. Like, that's not really saving someone, is it? So, when you look at Taxi Hunter, on the other hand, Anthony Wong does give some layers to the character, so it's more, you can definitely,
it's more, like, yeah, it's more deeper. Nuanced, largely because of Wong's portrayal.
Yeah, but like, portrayal, I mean, yeah. Yo, definitely you just weird, like, now, Taxi Driver's a scumbag, then it's killing them all.
I just got hit for a taxi, and this scumbag overcharged me. I just gave you an idea for a fucking film.
M&O should have printed at that time, like, some like Taxi Drivers has come back, you know, like a cab, but like instead of like taxi TDAS, like, but that doesn't really roll off the tongue in the same way as a cab, so I don't think they went with that. But it really is 100% a movie with no nuance about Taxi Drivers.
I was about to say something. Sorry, I just literally just had this thought, but it's gone now. Keep on talking. Sorry.
But regardless of that, I think both are really interesting. It's partly because that's the thing I really love about Hong Kong cinema, is how much you see of the city and how important the role of the city is in those movies. And Taxi Driver or Taxi Hunter, for me, hits that spot perfectly. Like, it's not a complex story, but it has all that urban violence element and like the charm of Hong Kong back in the 90s. It almost felt really strange when I looked at the time. I was like, wait, it's 93, because it really feels almost like an 80s movie.
Yeah,
there's a very much 80s feel to it. Like, it's a film too.
Yeah. I agree with that. And even like the design of Anthony Wong's character is very 80s, actually. In terms of his glasses and his white collar shirt. In fact, the white collar worker, the image of the white collar worker is a very 80s thing. And I think that's why you probably got that vibe. Because, yeah, we do have white collar workers in the 90s, but it's a very different vibe, I find. Maybe I'm misremembering.
But I think you're right. I think that maybe is also one of the things that's one of the points of Falling Down, actually. Because in Falling Down, the character Michael Douglas plays has lost his job. And I feel like that's the thing with both Michael Douglas and Anthony Wong in both their roles, is that they're both out of their time. And that's why they have such severe reaction. At least that's obviously, it's react like this, but like that's how you can sort of put it in the context, is that they're out of their time and then they have a severe reaction because of that.
They're somewhat out, because if you look at, because they are depicted as older or slightly out of touch people compared to like the other characters who are, I guess, seen as city slickers. You know, in fact, if you look at like his boss, he's very 90s in his design, his haircut, his fucking dress sense, and I was like,
he's younger too, isn't he?
Yeah, which I was a bit like, that's interesting. but yeah, no, I agree with your sentiment that it does feel 80s, but I think that's largely by the fact that it's largely from the design of the main character, Kim, and like you said, he's very out-touched. Yeah, he's quite low in the social or economic ladder. Even though he's actually he's doing well, but he's not. He's essentially your typical.
He's not winning.
Yeah, he's your typical, dare I say, middle class. You know,
lower middle class office worker, not like struggling a bit because he's being told at the beginning like, oh, you did such good results and you brought us so much money. But then later on, when you see where he works, it's like he doesn't really have an office space for. He has a desk.
A cubicle.
Yeah, it's like, just a cubicle. There's not much to him. Like, he's not being awarded anything. And the fact that he got some contract actually after that, once he loses his wife, is like, well, you're not working hard enough. I'm like, yeah, I got you some money. And also, my wife died. Like, that doesn't matter. So he's definitely not very high on the corporate ladder compared to. So Mantat Hink are. Not so good cop. He's very 90s because he's got like everything. He's got the like all the basketball gear of all the best teams of the time.
It's the denim jacket.
he's so You know what? In Lethal Weapon, you got the character always goes,
Joe Pesci.
Too old for this shit.
Oh, no, yeah. Danny Glover.
He's always too old for this shit. Whereas, like, him is the opposite. He's like, he's older. He looks older than Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon, but he looks like, no, I'm not too old for this shit. I'm still young.
You know what? You know what, Matt? He's like the man after my own heart. We are, like, Lex guys, shrimps. We're still doing, you know, it's probably deep kid stuff, you know. You still collect toys. I still watch cartoons and like watch films. You know, we're way into like 30s and 40s. It's like, no, we're still doing this. My dad is our idol at this point in terms of, you know, winning at life.
God, I think I'm gonna start depression right now.
No, don't. It's good that we're doing this. I would say that Anthony Chu, probably more. Or maybe that's just the product of ambition, in that young ambition, in that she comes across as more mature than her own dad.
She's more capable, yeah.
Yeah.
She's more capable. She does have... Also, she has a point in the toxic masculinity part, because at some point, the two cops, her dad and Hong Kong Yu, are like laughing or having, I don't know, some kind of fun. And she's basically worried that they're gay. It is like... Okay, chill, girl. Like,
yeah, which I was a bit like, when I read that, I was like, did she say they were gay? I can't remember that. I was like,
it's really, really, it's one of those difficult scenes where I'm like, why is this a problem? Like, why is this played for jokes?
So I will say this, maybe contextually, this may actually, form it, maybe it won't, I don't know, you be the judge of that. So same-sex coupling in Hong Kong, same-sex coupling between two males in Hong Kong was actually deemed illegal until 1991.
Yeah, right, that does bring a lot of context.
So when it was actually legalized in 91, obviously that's 93, still really recent, like 2 years in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So a lot of that mentality from that that particular law still permeates within the Hong Kong mindset.
Yeah,
so,
and to be fair, every 90s movie is homophobic. Like, maybe not every 90s movie, but like most 90s movies are homophobic as hell.
Exactly. But I think in this particular case, it's very much like, oh, that's... And also, it's also two men who are working, you know, under the law. You know, so it's doubly risky if that was like, oh yeah, in her mind, it's doubly risky because of like two Hong Kong cops having a same sex couple and an affair. That's actually bad. And I think there was actually a case at the time where I think it was like, correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, but you know, I've read this somewhere, so hopefully I'm actually not delivering misinformation. Don't try to learn anything from us. But anyway, I will say this. There was actually a case where a high-ranking police officer committed suicide when it was discovered that he was in a same-sex relationship with another man.
That would be unsurprising as hell. like that's the most unsurprising story you could ever told me.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, outed and commit suicide because of the social consequences? Crazy. Yeah. Never happened.
Yeah. Never. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so I even though it's played for quote unquote jokes, I think there's something to be said about the Hong Kong mindset at the time. And
it's just eye rolling jokes. Like,
it's
honestly,
so not
compared to the eye rolling moments with the dad. I feel like I have more sympathy for the dad at that moment where she says that. I'm like, come on, girl. I expect you better of you. Come on. But him, on the other hand, I expect nothing. And I'm fine with it.
You know what? If that's your thing, you know, just go ahead and do it, mad dad. Just go ahead and do it. So, yeah, that's... Yeah, I... Oh God. But still a film worth watching. Yeah, that being said...
Oh, it's fantastic.
Fantastic film.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Definitely worth watching. It's an exploitation movie. It doesn't have, like, a lot of depth, but I think for all the reasons, which are essentially the fact that you, for a movie that was shot in 20 days, it looks like $1 million. Like,
yeah.
Let's get real. Like, 100%.
100%.
Like, with more budget, they could have done a lot more. But for what it is, it's great.
What they pulled out in, like, 20 days, like a full-length feature, is absolutely incredible, and it's a testament to, like, the Hong Kong players of that industry. Not just Anthony Wong and Han Yeo, just everyone involved.
Every person involved. Beautiful teamwork.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
a lot of one shots, apparently. Like, that's what he was saying. Yeah. Is like, you don't have more times. Like, everything, like, most of the stuff is single shots. And you look at the performances, and even stuff like I said at the beginning, when the doctor delivers the news of, like, oh, your wife just died, and just walks away.
Yeah.
Yeah, technically, maybe if it's a single shot, maybe they could have redone it. But, like, the fact that he's so matter-of-fact about it and just moves on is even makes it even, like, better in the context of the movie, because it's, like, it makes everything worse.
100%. So
a lot of the idiocy of it, some of it is dangerous, because at the end there's really a car chase where it's, like, obviously one of those car chases where they were waiting on the side, like, there's no car, okay, run. And then
there's the police thing, catching us.
Continuity, there's another car. But yeah, it adds so much to the movie. It's just a brilliant, brilliant piece of Hong Kong history in terms of visually what you can see in the street, the overall aesthetic, the atmosphere, Anthony Wong's performance, just pitch perfect.
I mean, it's kind of, I mean, we talked about this, that this is not your typical category three film, and it's not even a category three film, but it's often lumped together with other category three films.
Yeah.
And I tend to see this as kind of like a loose, one part of a very loose trilogy, I suppose. This being with the other Anthony Wong, Herman Yao collaborations being Ebola Syndrome and Untold Story.
Untold Story, yeah. I'm more interested in Untold Story out of the remaining
Untold
two.
Story is a much more interesting film, to be fair, and it's actually based on, like, a real life event.
Yeah, it looks very disturbing. Watching the trailer,
Ebola Syndrome is essentially a comedy about a man who's willing to just pull it all out there somehow. It's one of those films that just pushes the boat for the sake of pushing the boat.
That's what I heard, I always heard about it as, like, this kind of, like, murky and, like, very difficult, like violent, like, movie.
Let's put it this way. I could probably smell the sweat in Anthony Wong's forehead by watching that film. That's how murky that film is.
But you are not the only person who described it as kind of a comedy, because the person that we were promoting the book of from who wrote the book about
Ringo Lam?
Ringo Lam, sorry.
Yeah.
The man who wrote the book about Ringo Lam told me that when we were talking about Ebola Syndrome, he was like, yeah, it's a comedy. Like, it's so over the top. It just goes so far that you cannot take it seriously.
Yes, exactly. And that's a film with a lot of heinous acts in there. Like, literally.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I'm not that keen on watching it, because the basic plot is really terrible. But
yeah, I don't think
Untold Story, more curious about.
I know Untold Story, I think you would find it to be a more interesting watch. It's still heinous, let's put it that way, but it's let's put it this way, it's not played for laughs. I don't know why I need to preface that, but given Ebola Syndrome's existence, I have to, like, say
yes. It's one of those things where when you put it in context, it is important to mention.
I don't think we'll ever cover Ebola Syndrome in this podcast. I don't know if you want to cover
I do
Untold
not
Story.
Know I'll see maybe one day if I have the stomach for it. But, yeah.
I mean, however, I have all I did send you a photo of all the Blu-ray, all the Anthony Wong slash Herman Yao collaboration on Blu-ray as a, like a trilogy, as a nice little trilogy. And
that's a nice box set for the full family at Christmas. Definitely think about it.
And folks, audience, if you think him saying Christmas, it was like him throwing a random word. No, I did send him that photo on Christmas time because that's when I was watching it. And I think I got COVID afterwards, straight afterwards. So I was clearly being punished for it. So,
From that, I want to mention the Blu-ray from 80th Films for Taxi Hunter. Beautiful stuff. Really, really, really nice cover. I think they have a little poster in it. I might even put it up. It's great. Yeah, and the bonuses are super interesting. So they really did like really good number. It's really worth picking up.
You mentioned on your notes a couple of issues though, which I personally haven't noticed those issues. Maybe I was
like a blurriness of the picture at time, but it was like on two times.
Oh, okay.
I think one or two, but I think that's just because it was shot on film, probably not preserved that well.
I think I know the scenes you're talking about. You have to bear in mind, shot in 20 days, blurry scenes. It's probably the camera being out of focus
absolutely
at certain places.
So it's not a perfect rendition, but for what it is, and it's never
going to be a perfect rendition. It's a film shot in 20. It's a quote unquote exploitation film shot in 20 days. It's never going to reach fucking Steven Spielberg.
It's not 4K, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
but like,
yeah,
who
exactly
cares? It's,
yeah,
and honestly, it happens like once or twice. So
at this point, all I care about is the preservation of.
Yes, absolutely.
I think the fact that these films are coming on.
Yeah, it is super important.
Super important.
I'm gonna say though, in the bonus, so I mentioned the interview. I really want to mention the interview a bit more because until long, I do not have a screen capture of
he sent
what
me the
looks
screen
like
capture. But does he have eyeliner? Because I swear to God, he looks.
Yeah, there's some. I don't know what's going
there's
on.
Something
like,
going,
that,
there's something
he has
yet
a shirt that's the kind of stuff that only Yakuza characters in the Yakuza games wear, and even they probably would look like, come tone it down, like. And the goatee and like the moustache, like he's playing D'Artagnan. Like, I don't know if he was preparing for a role at the time of the interview. And
probably.
He was like, well, I gotta
was
have
this,
that.
This was an archive interview. It wasn't like a recent cyber interview. It was an archive. It was like an interview from like a good number of years ago. Was it
like
a recent interview?
It's confusing. It's very much just like, what? The minutes I was like watching, I was like, is this a fever dream? Like, why is he like this? Like, this is insane. And then again, the interview is so fun. So I really want him to host a talk show. Like bring out like.
Does he have a podcast? Does he have a podcast?
Oh, that'd be great. But also, he mentions the fact that he wants to do more work at the time in England. That he thinks himself as British. And
yes,
so, like crazy shit. So I'm like, calm down, Tony Wong.
Please,
just like, we'll hang out. I'll make so much research to be able to interview him decently and like have proper questions that are respectful and be like, I want to know more about your craft.
Your
and
process.
Also, can you bitch more about the industry?
Bitch more about the Hong Kong industry because I love it when you bitch. He, you know what? He really does love bitching, and you know what? I love hearing him bitch about the Hong Kong industry.
There's
because
nothing wrong with that.
Honestly, most of the stuff he says are not unfounded. To be fair, like it can't. Like I said, the Hong Kong cinema industry, as much as I am fond of it and love it to bits, can get vapid and very like overly commercial, and where it's ain't fucking good. So yeah, it's. I think he's one of those actors who's just brutally honest, and I appreciate that honesty.
Absolutely, yeah. It's his point of view. It might not be always, you know, perhaps there's more nuance to offer to his certain of his opinion.
Well,
but
I mean, I can understand it given the fact that he's coming from a very personal experience, and you know, you're going to be informed by your own personal experiences. I'm not gonna blame him.
No, why would we? Something you want. Legend.
Anthony Wong. Legend. Acting idol, frankly.
So much to learn from this man.
Absolutely. Again,
he acts like a plumber with such ease, where it's like, he goes somewhere and he does this performance, and it's always just pitch perfect. But he doesn't try to make it complicated. Like, he's not trying to pretend that he's something more than who he is. And I appreciate that so much with character actors and actors in general. Like, character actors is a bit dismissive term, I feel. But,
I don't really like that term, character actor. I think Sam Rockwell actually spoke a little bit about that term, and that it suggests that, oh, you don't have any leading man status, or you can't lead a film because you're just a character actor that supports the lead actor. But character actors can be lead actors. I think, 100%. To me, in my head, it's like, I find that people who call themselves character actors are just like, well, it kind of suggests that, yeah, they can actually act, they can actually take on any role and do it well, whereas leading roles, they can only, they're just selling the star. So in a way, you don't really have to know how to act. That makes any sense. Like, as in, like, don't have that much range. I'm not saying that lead actors can't have range, but I think that's the conventional wisdom among performers, particularly in Hollywood, and probably more so in. But yeah, no, I would say Anthony Wong, great all-round actor, regardless if he's leading or supporting.
100%.
And Taxi Hunter,
a classic.
Classic, more than evidence of his abilities.
Yes. Yeah, and that's it. Really pick up Taxi Hunter, whatever you can. It's a fantastic watch. And it's not like the most amazing movie you've ever seen, but it's a very, very solid watch.
Very solid watch. And if you're like into the, if you're scared of the category three films, or like scared, or like somewhat trepidatious about like looking at some of Anthony Wong's early work, and his collaboration with Hermann Yao, largely because it, you know, turns your stomach. Which, you know, I understand. I think Taxi Hunter is a good film to start.
It's a bit graphic, but not too graphic.
No, I mean, there are definitely some horrific moments, namely the wife's death being.
Yeah, that is, but that, it's not like super bloody graphic. It is horrific because what is happening?
Yeah, what is happening before us, and the fact that it's. I think maybe a lot of it is because, you know, in your knowledge, it's kind of like, well, how are they going to like pull this off? And they did, and it's horrible, like horrific, not horrible, but horrible in the sense that it's bad quality, but horrific in the fact that they did actually turn it off, and they did manage to capture that visceral violence of just being dragged across the fucking road. On a speeding car, or being like by a speeding car.
Yeah, because it really is a scene where he feels like, oh, the car is really going that fast. Like there is not that sped up element that certain scenes might have, where you're like, okay, well, they were very slow and then they speeded it up, so it looks dangerous, but it wasn't that much. It's like, oh no, it doesn't look dangerous. Like,
So I think they did have to play with camera. Wait, they clearly played with camera speed, but I think dramatically.
I hope so, works. Because that is not good.
If you ask your actress, so what do you think about being dragged across the road?
Yeah, how do you feel about how do you feel about concrete? How much concrete is too much concrete?
You're okay with this? You're okay with this? You know, you're fine with this, right? We're paying you, so you should be fine.
Yeah, that's not a good way to approach a conversation about concerts. Like,
no, absolutely not. I don't think so.
Yeah, it's a great movie, but yeah, there's definitely moments where you'll be like, ooh.
You know what? Okay, I will say this. We would never cover this film ever in our life. Because frankly, the DVD is really hard to get at this point, and you know, I rather cover films that is easy to get. But there's this one film, and it's a very low C grade action film starring Moon Lee, and it's very much of the Girls with Gun films of that early 90s. And it's an okay film, but there's actually one particular scene where, you know, a big giant white guy No, it's actually in a speeding car, takes out his hand, grabs a little girl who FYI, this scene, yes, you know this girl who just came out of ballet class, right? I think she's still wearing her, ballet uniform, and she's literally hanging on for dear life a speeding car, and there's a guy, and I don't think it's actually a real arm. I think it's a prosthetic because, why would you hold on to this girl while just you're driving a car like literally 50 miles per hour while she's literally hanging on for dear fucking life?
Yeah, because it's definitely one of those scenes that I remember watching thinking like, okay, that's slowed down, but I still doesn't make up for the fact that this is atrociously dangerous.
Is it slowed down? I think it's slowed down. Is it slowed down? I don't know, man.
Honestly, she's being held by the hair, pulled by her hair. Even if it's not, like, I would prefer it was sped up because that would have less longer for that poor girl. This is no good. This is what
great actress, less trauma after this. Great actress. I hope she wasn't traumatized, but great little actress. For a film that probably didn't deserve it.
Salute
to
the soldier of Hong Kong cinema. Like, you did a lot.
But that, in terms of like speeding cars and being dragged across the road, that was the only other scene that I just came to mind. Again, we'll never cover it. Guys, YouTube it.
Until Eureka reissues it on Blu-ray.
That'd be hilarious.
Oh, well, you can count on it for next season. I can do that much.
Guys, we literally hit past our 2 hour mark. This has been Hong Kong Gore. Thank you for listening to us like ramble aimlessly about this film. No, this amazing film, admittedly, but solid amazing film, a product of Hong Kong history. And Matt, anything you want to say to our audience?
No, apart from check us out our page on Instagram and tell us what you think about the episodes, and we hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, we hope you enjoy it. And seriously, if you have any suggestions, if you want us to talk about any other Hong Kong films that we probably would never think to cover, please send us your suggestions because we're only like...
There's 12 episodes in. That means it's our first year. So thank you for being with us for our first year.
Yes.
Also.
Yes.
And
indeed.
There's more to come. And we got ideas for more. So stay tuned.
You know what? I have this one idea for our Christmas episode that I think you will actually like. We may need to stop the recording, but I want to do something that is potentially comedy, and I'll probably be it will come across as ironic, but it's coming from genuine love. But we'll talk about it after this episode.
Perfect.
Okay. All I can say is multiverse. That's all I'm gonna say. Okay. Good night, folks.
Bye.